So now you're ready for some real fun. So what we're going to do now is we're going to compare these newer nonsteroidals. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at data that's been generated during the approval process. And then we're going to look at some of the data that's been generated post-approval, trying to make sense out of which of these drugs might be preferred. First thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about efficacy, and I'm going to say it just very shortly, and I'm going to just share with you a little bit of data that's out there. If we want these drugs to be efficacious, then we want them to impair COX-2. So as we look at this data, what this data does is it looks at the amount of COX-2 that's been inhibited at either 2 hours, 8 hours, or 24 hours, and these are the drugs that have been studied. And this was before varicoxib was approved, and that's why it's not up there. And so what you see here, just looking at it pictorially, and I'm much more a picture person. I can see things with a picture much more easily. Well, Rimadyl's got all the high bars, and high bars are what we want. So this study implies that Rimadyl is the best at an inhibiting COX-2, the bad guy. And then you can see variable responses of the others. The other thing that is glaring is that aspirin is terrible. It does very little inhibition of COX-2. So this study suggests that Rimadyl is the best, Medicam may be second best, and aspirin is the worst. The problem is, guess who sponsored this study? We're going to come back to that in just a couple minutes. That's the problem with these studies. We need unbiased, well-controlled clinical trial that is not sponsored by a drug company that looks at all of these drugs. And so because of this, I'm going to be handicapped in offering you information about relative efficacy. Same sort of thing here. This is varicoxib compared to carprofen. Varicoxib did better than did carprofen, but this is a Mariel-sponsored study. And so all of the drug companies, none of them are going to publish a paper that doesn't have their product do better, and I'm not slamming them for that, at least I'm not intending to, but that's a problem with looking at studies that are sponsored by drug companies. So I'm not going to say too awful much about efficacy. I will come back and say a little bit about Zubrin, because as I alluded to before, of the nonsteroidals, its mechanism of action is a little bit different. It is referred to as a dual inhibitor. A dual inhibitor means it targets both cyclooxygenases and lipoxygenases. Now, it turns out for Zubrin, it targets both COX-1 and COX-2, as well as the leukotrienes. Because of that, presumably, it makes perfect sense to me that this drug does have hope as potentially being better from an efficacious standpoint compared to our other nonsteroidals. And so I think that Zubrin should have a little bit of a niche, and it can be a drug that you might default to when an animal has not responded to the other nonsteroidals. Now, you might be saying, isn't this drug less safe? We'll come back to that here very shortly. So, when we look at safety, the first thing that we're going to have to do is we're going to have to talk about this COX-1 to COX-2 ratio. And I'm going to do this not because I want this to be a basis of selection for you. I'm doing it because when a drug company sales rep comes to you and says, my drug's COX-1, COX-2 ratio is the best, you can know what kind of questions to ask that individual. What are we talking about here? It's just a potency issue. We want our drug to be more potent for COX-2 compared to COX-1. That means we want it to take more drug to get COX-1 compared to COX-2. So if a drug takes 2 times as much drug to get COX-1 as COX-2, the ratio would be 2, and it would be a better drug. So what have we got here? Well, this is the amount of drug necessary to inhibit 50% of COX-2 in the yellow, and the amount of drug necessary to inhibit 50% of COX-1 in green. What we want is to see lots of green and little yellow, because we want it to take a lot more drug to get the good guy, which is green, compared to the bad guy, which is yellow. And what you see, of course, for aspirin is it's terrible. It takes a lot more drug to get the bad guy than it does to get the good guy. On the other hand, if we look at ibuprofen, which is among the safest of the traditional nonsteroidals, it's about equal. It takes about the same amount of drug to get the good guy, the green, as it does to get the bad guy, the yellow. Here's etodolac, and etodolac is exactly what we want. We want this drug, we want it to take a lot of drug to get the good guy, the green, and not much drug to get the bad guy. And here's carprofen, it's just the opposite of etodolac. Now normally when they measure COX-1, what they'll measure is platelet production of cyclooxygenases, and for COX-2, they'll measure macrophage production of cyclooxygenases. Well, this story suggests that etodolac is a much safer drug compared to carprofen, and in fact, that's what Fort Dodge suggested. Now, I've now put numbers to those ratios. We've got 2 columns. Why? Because this is inhibitory concentration 50%. as far as I'm concerned, as a clinician standpoint, I don't care about 50%. I'd much rather see inhibition of 80% activity, so we're going to focus on that. So we get rid of the 50, and now we draw our line. Anything above this line has a ratio less than 1. Anything below this line has a ratio greater than 1, and it means it takes more drug to get COX-1 compared to COX-2. And you see this ratio here for carprofen is 0.25, and here it is for Atotolac at 8.7, so it implies that Atotolac is a much safer drug. Well, the problem with this, and here's, of course, Celebrex at about 5, and here's Rofecoxib at about 17. The problem with this is it's people. If you turn around and do the same thing in dogs, using dog macrophages and dog platelets, you get an entirely different picture. Now carprofen is way down here at 129, and here's Atotolac way up here at 0.52. So what gives here? Well, look at this data. I'm not sure that I believe this because, look, yeah, maybe Atotolac is 0.52, but look, here's meloxicam where it belongs, but here's meclofenamic acid. Now, I don't know about you, but I've seen dogs die from meclofenamic acid. It's a bad drug. It does bad goo-juice to dog. And you're telling me it's similar to a meloxicam? I don't think I believe that clinically for a minute, nor do I believe that phenylbutazone should be on the bottom of this. I think it should be above there. So I look at this with a bit of jaundiced eye. So then what I did is I went to the literature and I got all the investigators that have done any of the COX-1, COX-2 ratios in dogs, and I put down in this table what they did and what they found. So here's the study that we just looked at. This was Ricketts. Not all the investigators have studied all the drugs. And if you go down there, you will see that in each column, one drug shines real well. Now this asterisk here refers to cats. Bridot actually looked at dogs and cats. The problem with this is I bet if you were to highlight all of the drugs that did best in each of these columns, you would probably be able to guess which drug company sponsored the particular study. And in fact, you would be right. This is a Pfizer study. This is a Merial study. This is a Boehringer Ingelheim study. This is a Merial study. And this is a Novartis study. And that's the problem with this. The drug company is going to have, the drug company, for whatever reason, is probably going to publish the study that has their drug shine. And I'm not saying that they're, the bottom line is, you can't look at this data without being somewhat biased. It's impossible, in my mind, to be able to compare this information across investigators. The other problem with these studies is it depends upon the method that they use, cell cultures versus whole blood. Well, whole blood is preferred because at least with whole blood you can take things into account like protein binding and body temperature and those sort of things. This was a cloned cyclooxygenase isoform, which probably explains why Darrocoxib did so well, 1300. So, bottom line is do not use a COX-1, COX-2 ratio as a basis of selection. It's good for screening purposes, maybe, but beyond that, I'd be very careful with this information. Now, can we make sense out of this information? Is there some whole body or whole animal studies that help support the possibility that carprofen is better than meloxicam, is better than etogesic? Well, the next thing that we're going to look at then is the preclinical toxicity studies that are mandated by the FDA during the approval process. Now, what we're going to do is, remember, this is a toxicity situation. We're trying to induce toxicity. We're doing it on purpose. Now, before we go forward, here's where I stop and I just ask you a couple questions. And here's the question. What level of adverse events are acceptable to you for your patients? In other words, how many adverse events are you willing to live with out of a certain population? Is 1 out of 10, if a drug causes an adverse event, 1 out of 10 times, is that acceptable to you? Okay. 1 out of 100 times. Is that acceptable to you? Okay. Now, if this were your child or your significant other taking this drug, would that 1 out of 100 times still be acceptable to you? Depends on the drug. So let's say gastrointestinal toxicity. Would that be acceptable to you? 1 out of 100. That means 1 out of 100 patients that you put on carprofen is going to come back with GI upset, toxicity. All right, so I'm seeing some yeses and some nos. 1 out of 1,000? Now, the FDA wouldn't tolerate that in a heartbeat, and you wouldn't tolerate it. If it turned out that Vioxx was causing strokes in 1 out of 1,000 people, you wouldn't tolerate that for a second. You'd accept 1 out of 10,000. Okay, so, and your point is taken. It depends upon the toxicity. So let's go back to, let's say, 1 out of 1,000. I would feel comfortable potentially with 1 out of 1,000. How many dogs would we have to study to pick up on that 1 out of 1,000 dogs that develops a GI upset? Probably about 6,000, 3,000 to 6,000. Okay. So how many dogs do you think were studied during the toxicity phase of the pre-approval process? Yeah, 6 if you're lucky. Okay. My point here is the time to look at toxicity of these drugs is when the drug has been approved and it's in widespread use. And I'm going to come back to that in just a couple minutes. So we're going to use this information as an indicator, but once again, we can't get too cavalier. So having said that, package insert data, carprofen studied at 5.7 times the dose for 1 year in 6 dogs, no gross or histologic lesions. You know, to me, that's a pretty darn safe drug. Even if it's just 6 dogs, compared to aspirin, I'd be killing dogs with aspirin. 10 times the dose for 14 days, mild histologic lesions. So pretty safe drug. Now what we're going to do is we're going to start with the first drug that was approved, and then we're going to go in the order of approval. The next one approved was Etodolac. 5.3 times the recommended dose, 6 out of 8 animals died, the first within 3 weeks, the remaining took 9 months, and they all died associated with GI ulceration. So immediately I see this and I go, even though we're not inducing toxicity in our clinical patients, this suggests to me that Etodolac is not as safe as carprofen. So it's down at the bottom of my list. Duracoxib. Duracoxib is a quote-unquote coxib. They got approved about the time that Vioxx was withdrawn from the market, but I think that they were trying to take advantage of the coxib relationship between safety and efficacy. And it is probably true, a drug that is a coxib probably is safer than the traditional drugs, but a drug does not have to be a coxib to be relatively selective for COX-2. So don't get caught up in it's a coxib, therefore it is better. And bear in mind, one bad thing about coxibs maybe is that they are sulfonamides. Because they are sulfonamides, if you are worried about sulfonamide allergies, you're probably going to see it with a coxib as easily as you would see it with an antibiotic. So bear that in mind. All right, so having said that, it was studied at 3 times the dose for 21 days, no significant findings. Well, I can't do too awful much with that for comparative sake because carprofen was studied at 10 times the dose for 14 days and 5 times the dose for 1 year. So it doesn't help me place it. And then for whatever reason, the FDA asked Novartis to study this drug using a different formulation. It's not the formulation that is marketed. It is a different formulation. But when they did that, at 3 times the dose for 2 weeks, they had jejunal ulcers and erosions in 2 of the animals. Now, because whenever the drug undergoes approval and does a study, the FDA requires that information make it to the package insert. So I'm just going to warn you that this is not the commercial available one, but nonetheless, this worries me. But here's the other thing that worried me. When given at 3 times the recommended dose, Duracoxib underwent nonlinear kinetics. What does that mean? Well, remember that zero order versus first order stuff you learned in second year pharmacology or biochemistry? That stuff's pretty important. It means we go from a logarithmic elimination to a linear elimination, and that means that drug concentrations can skyrocket very easily. So in my mind, even though this was 3 times the recommended dose, what I worry about is the animal that has decreased liver function. Maybe it's an 12-year-old dog, a geriatric patient. Or the animal that has liver disease and it's subtle and we don't know about it. Or those poor metabolizers. So I would be careful with Duracoxib, and this is clearly a drug that you don't want to overdose. Yes, ma'am? I'm sorry? It was for 14 days. So at 14, in these animals, they demonstrated nonlinear kinetics. I'm going to guess it doesn't really make any difference. 3 times the dose, and it probably will, because the half-life of this drug is 3 hours. So for this drug to accumulate, it's got to happen pretty fast. So I'm going to assume it, in some animals it will happen fast versus long. All right, to finish up, 8 times the dose for 14 days, we saw vomiting, melanin, and GI lesions in most of the animals. Now, this compares to 10 times the dose for carprofen for 14 days, where there was no clinical signs, no gross lesions, some histologic lesions. So Duracoxib, in my mind, now is below carprofen from a safety standpoint. Meloxicam, we're a little bit handicapped because we don't have much information on the package insert. They only studied it at 5 times the dose. They saw no gross lesions, but they did see microscopic lesions at 6 months. So where does this fit? Well, maybe above diracoxib, but it's probably still below carprofen, only because I don't have enough information. It is a sulfonamide, so be careful. Bear in mind, it is a sulfonamide. And then ferricoxib is the last one. It is also a sulfonamide. It was studied at 5 times a dose for 6 months. One animal developed ulceration. A couple of animals developed inflammation. So below carprofen, is it above diracoxib? I don't really know, but it's certainly below carprofen, and I'm not sure if it's equal to meloxicam. The problem with this drug is this. I think that Muriel has a lot of confidence in their drug. They had so much confidence in their drug, they decided to study it in the juvenile animal. Now, no other drug, no other company has done this. And so we've got to bear that in mind as we look at the data. But it was not a good thing to do because these dogs do not tolerate this well at young ages. Well, the three out of five animals developed fatty livers. But at 5 times the dose for 6 months, 1 out of 12 animals died, 4 out of 12 animals were euthanized because they were found moribund in their cage. So this does not sound good, and this is something you don't want to put on your label. If you discontinue the drug at 10 weeks, the animals will survive. And unfortunately, they had to put this on their label because they did the study. So this isn't something they could withhold from us. So, on the one hand, I applaud Muriel for doing this in juvenile animals, and I would say that this means that juvenile animals, we've got to be very careful with these drugs, but on the other hand, this makes me a little bit nervous. Now, it was studied at 10 times the dose, only 4 dogs for 22 days, 3 out of 4 animals developed small ulcers, and 1 developed a severe ulcer. Well, the carprofen group only received it for 14 days, but to me, this still suggests that this isn't as safe as carprofen. One other thing to be worried about with ferricoxib, it has 38% bioavailability. That means 38% of the dose that you give is doing the effect. No big deal, except what happens if another dog has 50% bioavailability or maybe 70% bioavailability. You have doubled the dose of the drug without really knowing it. And so I would much rather a drug have 100% bioavailability because then I don't have this variability. So just be aware, the goal here is to counsel clients, just be cognizant of the fact that there are some things about ferricoxib that should cause you to be a little bit careful, perhaps more than the others. If we come back to this study, now we're looking at safety. What we want here is suppression. We don't want suppression of COX-1. We want to see bars as high as, we want to see no bars, so we want to see zero suppression of COX-1. And when we look at this data, what again you see is that aspirin has suppression close to 100% throughout a 24-hour period, which means that it's not a safe drug at all, versus these other drugs. Rimadyl was pretty safe, followed by diracoxib and etagesic. The bottom line is the only thing I can walk away with this study is that aspirin is not safe. It is not a particularly good drug. What about tapoxilin? It targets COX-1 and COX-2. Since it's getting COX-1, doesn't that mean it's not a safe drug? Well, if you look at its data on its package insert, it was studied. This is the placebo in yellow. This is 2 times the dose in gray. This is 10 times the dose in blue. And this is 30 times the dose in this dark gray for 1 year. And what you see is at 30 times the recommended dose, 1 animal developed an ulcer. At 10 times the recommended dose for a year, no animals developed an ulcer. In fact, when they went for 2 years at 30 times the recommended dose, only 3 animals developed an ulcer. This drug seems to be extremely safe. Why? Well, because it targets leukotrienes, and it turns out that leukotrienes are responsible for the vasoconstriction and the platelet aggregation that is necessary for ulcer formation. So while you are impairing COX-1 and COX-2, what you're also doing is preventing the ulcer from being formed. So there is reason to believe that this drug might be more efficacious and potentially safer compared to our other traditional nonsteroidals. Well, what we need to do is look at the clinical trials, because with the clinical trials, now we get those ends up so that we can see perhaps the emergence of more frequent side effects. So all I've done is, again, gone to the package inserts, and if there was a significant difference between the placebo and the nonsteroidal, as far as vomiting is concerned, I put it on this list. Carprofen with 900 animals had no significant difference in gastrointestinal side effects compared to placebo. We compare that to the drugs that I thought were going to be worse, not ferricoxib, but Etodolac, and maybe diracoxib, and we see that both of them had more vomiting compared to the placebo, but it wasn't that high an incidence of vomiting. Meloxicam and Tepoxifen, which I thought were going to be pretty safe, had a pretty high incidence of vomiting, but the placebos were high as well. Nonetheless, the placebos, the vomiting was higher in the treatment group compared to the placebos, but I think the placebos were close to 15 and 20% as well. So I look at this, the reason I have question marks here by ferricoxib is because its control group was etagesic. It wasn't a placebo group. It was etagesic, and there was not any significant difference between the two groups as far as vomiting is concerned, and it was about 10%. So I look at this, and I guess what I walk away with is all of them are going to cause vomiting, but carprofen appears to be the safest. And so what we saw with our clinical, with our toxicity study, seems to be borne out with the field trials. Okay, so now let's look at the post-market information. And the first thing I'm going to show you is a study that's old, but this is the way that it needs to be done. This group looked at, this was a long time ago, and the only thing approved were Rimadyl and etagesic, and they compared it to ascriptin, which is a buffered aspirin, not ascriptin, but bufferin, a buffered aspirin, and a placebo group. And what they looked at were endoscopic lesions, and they actually scored these endoscopically, and they used the current recommended doses for these drugs. Carprofen, not current, but carprofen was actually given twice a day, etagesic once a day. And, of course, now carprofen is approved for use at once a day. So what they found, they scored these animals once a week, baseline, no differences among the groups, placebo blue, aspirin yellow, carprofen green, and etodolac pink. And what they found is within 5 days of therapy, aspirin lesions shot up there, got a score of 25, and they stayed there versus the newer nonsteroidals. Neither one of them had GI ulceration that was significantly different from baseline. So this is one of the reasons that I tell you that aspirin is not particularly good. Okay. Well, what I'd like to do now is just share with you a little bit about the post-market surveillance, because I think this is where the information becomes important, and this is where I'm going to yell at you just a little bit. So when carprofen came out, I think that Pfizer did a most excellent job in trying to keep veterinarians informed about what was going on. They took some hard hits. They were slammed on the internet. They were slammed by the Wall Street Journal, and I think that they handled it quite well. There were some good things that came out of this, two good things. The first is the FDA said, whoa, we're not doing a good enough job in informing veterinarians about the side effects of these drugs. And so because of that, we want you to be a little bit more aggressive with the post-market pharmacovigilance. And so now we see these technical bulletins. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the tear sheets that I'll talk about in just a couple minutes. So let's look at the technical bulletin a little bit more closely, and we'll start with Pfizer's. It turned out that when they looked at the side effects of GI in the gastrointestinal tract was very low, 0.18%, so very low, and that's with 4 million users of these drugs. Only a third of those were probably due to the liver. So let's park here for just a little bit and talk about nonsteroidals and the liver disease. Now, when this first came out, it was Black Labs, and in fact, that came from Colorado, and all I can assume is that Colorado loves Black Labs, and they take care of their Black Labs, because in West Virginia, the other John Denver state, it's Yellow Labs, and in Texas, it's probably Catahoula dogs. The bottom line is, it's any dog can develop liver disease, and I think the breeds that show up are the breeds that we like a lot and we take care of a lot. So any breed, any kind of dog will do it, and any of these drugs will do it. Any drug that is metabolized by the liver increases the risk of liver disease. And the reason for that is this. The liver's job is to take a lipid-soluble drug and make it water-soluble. The way it's made water-soluble is by putting this big, chunky molecule on it so that it will go out the kidney. Glucuronic acid, glutathione. But the only way that big, chunky molecule can be added to a drug is if it is turned into an oxygen radical. And that's what phase one drug metabolism does. So it takes this drug, converts it to a radical, and very rapidly, that radical is then associated with or combined with a large clunky molecule. Well, the problem is the liver accumulates these oxygen radicals, and the higher the dose and the longer you're given the drug, the more oxygen radicals show up in the liver. Eventually, that liver is going to be depleted of protective factors. And so the higher the dose you give, the longer you use these drugs or anticonvulsants or any drug metabolized by the liver, the greater the risk of liver disease. So what do you do? All right, well, if this is a patient at risk, get your baseline data, and not just transaminases and not just alkaline phosphatase, but get function tests. Albumin, bile acids, in my mind, are the most sensitive as long as you do paired, you know, fasting and postprandial. Albumin, blood urea, nitrogen. These are all things that the liver does that function. If the bile acids, for example, are elevated in the animal, or if the transaminases are elevated in the animal, the liver enzymes are elevated, doesn't mean that you can't use this drug, but it means you probably need to watch this animal a little bit more closely. So about a week into therapy, I'd measure things again. And if everything's cool, then I'd measure them maybe in 3 weeks. And if everything's cool, then I'd measure them maybe in 3 months. I'd prolong my interval as long as everything is cool. But I'm going to still measure the animal as long as it's receiving the drugs. Maybe once every 6 months. And as this animal becomes more geriatric, maybe once every 3 months. If things start being elevated, then I'm going to look at my bile acids. And a single elevation of bile acids isn't going to worry me, but if I start seeing the trends in elevation, then it's time to stop the drug and it's time to go to something else. Now, if I do see liver disease, what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to treat it much the same as I would treat acetaminophen toxicosis, which is a hepatic necrosis issue. What I'm going to do is I'm going to treat with N-acetylcysteine, whether I give it intravenously as Mucamist or orally as an over-the-counter health food store or a chemical company store, doesn't make any difference. If you give it orally, it's going to go straight to the liver. But that's a form of glutathione. Glutathione is the guy that scavenges those oxygen radicals, and that's what the animal needs. So I'm going to do that. The other thing I might do is give SAMI. It does the same thing, probably not as directly, but it will increase glutathione in the liver. And I can use either of these to prevent toxicity as well. If I have a patient at risk, then I'll think about using these routinely in the animal while it's receiving this drug. The other thing that's here is Nutramax's answer to milk thistle. This is Marin. But milk thistle is one of the few herbs that I'm willing to say probably has therapeutic use in animals. Doesn't mean others don't, but it's the one that I've at least looked at the data and I have confidence in. SAMI's one of them, and glucosamine and chondroitin sulfates are also products that I think are good. As an aside, and we'll get here in just a couple minutes, any animal that's on a non-steroidal for osteoarthritis should be on chondroitin sulfates and glucosamines. Why? Well, one of the reasons, it'll protect the GI tract just a little bit better than not having that on board. So that is how I would approach the liver disease issue and just recognize it's going to happen in all animals. Now let's visit Diracoxib just a little bit. This is its pharmacovigilance pieces of information. And I just wanted to draw your attention to, first of all, one of the things that Diracoxib does or Novartis does that I like is they tell you how many tablets were sold. And that helps you start normalizing. If the other companies would do it, it would help you start normalizing if you're trying to compare data. They saw Labrador retrievers as 18% of the adverse events, but it turns out that Labrador retrievers are 15% of the registered dogs as well, so I don't think labs are predisposed, at least not yet. But I want you to see the side effects. Of the side effects reported, 51% of them were GI, no surprises there, but I was surprised to see that 22% of them were renal, and a whopping 15% were hepatic. I was surprised at that incidence. More problematic, 20% of these animals were either died or were euthanized. And 40% of these animals had concomitant disease. So it's just a reminder that be selective in using these drugs, and I would avoid using them in a patient that has concomitant disease as the body is trying to normalize and fight whatever is causing disease in the first place. Now I'm going to take this one step further. I think that Novartis is to be applauded for being brave enough to report this in JAFMA. What they did is from the pharmacovigilance data, they pulled out those animals that developed perforation. They had 29 animals, 45% of them were Labradors, don't know why they were so high. It turned out that of those 29 animals that developed perforation, and look at how many died, 68% of them died, were euthanized, 55% of them received a dose that was too high. Now remember I warned you about Duracoxib. This is the one that undergoes saturation kinetics. Good reason to not overdose. 55% of them were overdosed. 59% of those dogs had received, within the last 24 hours, another non-steroidal or another glucocorticoid. I cannot fathom why that should happen. When you look at the statistic, 90% of these animals that died, that had perforated ulcers, had one or the other of those go wrong. Was either overdosed or received another drug that targets COX-2. Seems to me if we can avoid using these drugs wrong, we can avoid a lot of these side effects. So their lesson to the profession, the reason they published this, was to kind of plead with us to use these drugs appropriately. Now, having said that, this is where I'm going to yell at you just a little bit. How many of you have seen an adverse event to non-steroidal? Okay. How many of you reported that to the FDA or the drug company? Okay. Not all of you, okay? How many of you know that tear sheets exist for these non-steroidals? Okay. And how many of you send these tear sheets home with your client? Okay. Pardon? 50%. Okay, you're to be applauded for doing that. If we are going to learn about the side effects of these drugs, the only way that we're going to learn about them is during the post-market phase. If you do not report adverse events to these drugs, then we are never, ever going to learn about them. Now, we're going to look at some FDA website information here in just a couple minutes. If you report an adverse event to a drug company, by law, they have to report that to the FDA. But I've talked to a couple of pharmaceutical reps that are involved with non-steroidals, and they tell me the best thing to do would be to report it directly to the FDA, just so you don't have to worry about selective reporting. So, and I will encourage you to do that. The FDA, you know, we slam the FDA, and on the one hand, we yell at them for not approving these drugs fast enough, but then when we have adverse events that happen in 1 out of 10,000 people, we slam them for approving these drugs. Then we give them a hard time for not having a good adverse event reporting system. Well, I think that they've done a really good job in trying to make that system on their website a lot more user-friendly, and they do make an attempt to try and correlate the adverse event to the use of the drug. So they'll try and get a feel for, was this really the drug versus not? So I'll encourage you to look at that. The other thing that I'm going to encourage you to do is to use the tear sheets. And when I ask veterinarians why they don't use the tear sheets, they tell me because it scares, they're afraid that the client will be scared when they read what's on there. And my response to that is that if I developed an adverse event or my daughter developed an adverse event to a drug and I found out that I was not given a tear sheet that could inform me about that, I would be absolutely livid. So from a professional liability standpoint, if you have these tear sheets or something similar that you can send the client home with and emphasize the importance of reading that, I think that is critical. In human medicine, the pharmacist assumes the role of counseling. In veterinary medicine, that role falls to you or your technician. And if you have not counseled your technician on how to counsel clients, I would do that because these drugs kill. And the most recent AVMA report, it was a non-steroidal toxicity in the cat, and it was for a different reason. It was informed consent wasn't garnered, and I'll talk about that in just a couple minutes. But the point is that professional liability is going to pay attention to how you counsel clients with these things. And in my mind, it makes sense to give them, if not this tear sheet, then a tear sheet that fully informs them. And then make the FDA CVM happy. Please report these adverse events. Find a technician and say one of your jobs is once a month, you sit down and you report these things. This is the adverse event reporting for non-steroidals in dogs, and I just wanted to show you what it looks like. This is carprofen, this is meloxicam, and this is duracoxib. And I've cut and pasted just a little bit so you can see some of the most important adverse events. They'll tell you the number of animals evaluated, 15,000 for carprofen, and the number of reacted. Well, which drug do you think is going to have the most adverse event reports on here? Carprofen, for two reasons. First of all, it's been approved a lot longer, but second of all, when the adverse events happened to carprofen, we weren't expecting it, and we reported it. If you have an adverse event now to furcoxib, I think the chances of you reporting that are going to be much less because you're kind of used to it now. I'm going to encourage you to report it anyway because we're not going to know unless you do. What I wanted you to see is the statistics. Oh, I'm missing my little bar here. When you look at the percent of animals developing vomiting compared to the number of reports, it's pretty much consistent among all of the non-steroidals. And the same is true with renal disease, except for duracoxib. In duracoxib, 17% of the animals also had renal disease issues. And so I'm a little bit worried that maybe duracoxib, more than the others, might be causing renal dysfunction. When you look at death due to... Oops, darn it. Oh, that's why. There we go. It's the wrong slide. When we look at death, the incidence of death or the proportion of death was about 20% for carprofen and duracoxib. Interestingly, it was only about 13% for meloxicam. And I'm not sure what that means, but maybe it means once an animal gets sick, it's easier to get them to recover with meloxicam. So that's just how the information looks. And I think, if nothing else, if you have an adverse event to a drug and you're wondering if other veterinarians have had it, you can go to this website. And this website is free. You can get in there, and it's pretty user-friendly, considering it's government-sponsored. So when we look at combination therapy, clearly we don't want you to combine nonsteroidals with glucocorticoids or with one another. I've already told you I do think that you should be using disease-modifying agents. In people, they've demonstrated that they respond better to nonsteroidals if a disease-modifying agent is on board for whatever reason. And that's another different session, but I'm a firm believer of those in animals that have osteoarthritis. And then there are a number of things that you can combine these things with. So you know that as better as I do. For glucocorticoids, one of the things that you can do if you want the same effect of glucocorticoids, remember they target not only COX-2, but also like the phospholipase way up here. Well, one of the things that you can do is you can use Rimadyl associated or any of the traditional non-traditional nonsteroidals with something like Accolade or Singulair. Those are leukotriene receptor antagonists. And so you might use those in combination if you're trying to control inflammation just a little bit more. Or, of course, as I told you before, you can use Zubrin, which does pretty much the same thing. Okay. I've already told you that. So do not extrapolate between species. However, having said that, it is reasonable that if an animal doesn't respond to one nonsteroidal, it might respond to another. Or if an animal doesn't tolerate one nonsteroidal, it might respond to another. So it is reasonable that you may be transitioning from one nonsteroidal to another. Well, what's the best way to do that? Well, about 2 years ago, if you were to ask drug companies, they'd tell you to wait 14 days. And I think the reason they were doing that is because aspirin, when it irreversibly acetylates platelets, you have to wait for new platelets to come along, and that takes 2 weeks. You don't have to wait, I don't think, that long before you transition from one to another. It makes sense to me that you don't want to have two nonsteroidals on board. So let's wait for one of them to be totally eliminated before we start the other. That means we simply need to look at the half-life. It takes 3 to 5 half-lives for the drug to be totally eliminated. So for Duracoxib, it has the shortest half-life. It's only 3 hours long. If you wait 5 half-lives, that's 15 hours. Well, if you're given Duracoxib once a day, you can go from Duracoxib on day 1 to carprofen on day 2 if you want to. It's only got its short half-life. As you go down the list, Ferricoxib with an 8-hour half-life, well, you need to wait at least 1 day. You may want to wait a little bit longer, maybe a day and a half. And as you go down the list, Topoxilin, it's metabolite that has the longer half-life of 45 hours. Meloxicam has the longest half-life of 20 hours. I'm sorry, Topoxilin's 13 hours. Meloxicam's 20 hours. So for these drugs, you need to wait about 60 hours or 2 to 3 days before you transition from it to another. So if I'm using meloxicam and I've decided I'm going to Duracoxib, I'm probably going to wait 3 days before I convert meloxicam to Duracoxib. Now, if there's any risk, be conservative. If you have a patient at risk, then wait an extra day. Or, if any doubt, protect. And as I said before, in this scenario, what we're going to want to do is probably use Pepcid, not omeprazole, because what we don't want to do is prolong the half-life. The other thing that you can do is use misoprostol, as I alluded to before, or sucralfate. Now, during the break, there was a question about toxicity, and I asked that person to raise their hand right about now. And your question, I think, was what happens when an animal ingests a full bottle of carprofen, liver-flavored, they taste really good. And this is true for any kind of situation. If you're in a toxicity situation, remember this. You're probably going to saturate the enzymes, okay? Just assume that you are to some degree. So at the very least, even if you didn't, you need to wait 3 to 5 drug half-lives before that drug is totally gone. So for meloxicam, if they ate a bottle of meloxicam, you'd have to wait a minimum of about 3 days before that drug is gone. For Duracoxib, it might be shorter, except, of course, the animal's ingested enough to saturate. So I would assume that the drug is going to have a much longer persistence than is suggested by the half-life. I would assume that the drug's going to be around at least a week. So that means that I'm going to treat for at least a week. If you are treating, it's tempted to tell you to use Prilosec because, I shouldn't say treating, if you're preventing in the scenario where the animal is ingested, it's tempting to tell you to use Prilosec because it is a better anti-secretory drug. But the problem is, I'm afraid it might inhibit drug metabolism even more. So I'm going to encourage you to go ahead and stick with Pepcid, but I would be using it at least twice a day because you're going to be having a lot of acidity on board, and this drug is a competitive inhibitor, and that means that sometimes you have to crank up the dose to get a better effect. So I'm going to be treating the animal with Pepcid at least for a week in a toxicity situation. I'm for sure going to have Carafate on board, and I'm probably going to have Misoprostol on board as well if I'm treating a toxicity. So any questions about toxicity? Did I answer your question? Okay. Okay. All right, so indications for nonsteroidals. We've pretty much covered most of what I wanted to say from indication. Just a couple of points. If you are using them to control non-medical pain, I'm going to encourage you to avoid using them in complicated metabolic diseases because of the risk of altering normal prostaglandin responses. Now, there's one exception, and the example here is banamine. We've used banamine to target endotoxic shock for a long time. It should make perfect sense. Remember, macrophages respond to endotoxin, and they are the ones that start that cascade. It makes perfect sense that a drug, a nonsteroidal, could shorten or could decrease that response. However, it doesn't have to be banamine. It can be any of these new COX-2 targeting drugs. So I would certainly use, if I was worried about endotoxemia, if I could get it in there early enough, any of these drugs, carprofen, meloxicam, any of them. Having said that, this is true for the parvovirus patient as well, but you're going to want to use them, of course, short term. The parvovirus patient, I understand that doesn't have, that gastrointestinal mucosa issues may be of concern, but at least for the first day or two, the animal doesn't have any gastrointestinal mucosa, so I'm willing to use a nonsteroidal in that scenario. But you'll need to discontinue it relatively rapidly. But when we were dealing with a potload of parvoviruses, to this day I can remember how rapidly an animal would pink up when I'd give it just a little touch of banamine, and I'm convinced it's because I was controlling the animal's pain, not because it had anything to do with the endotoxic shock. So I'll encourage you to think about using a nonsteroidal in patients with parvovirus short term, not only because of the potential endotoxemic effect, but because good visceral analgesia. And the dose is smaller. It can be the dose can be small, and in fact, we're going to be trying to use as small a dose as possible. And it is a one-time thing.
Would that be thinner if you were going to use Primidone?
It would be a one-time, maybe two times, one day, you know, one-time sort of thing to get them through this initial very painful period as you start stabilizing them with, and you need to make sure you stabilize with fluids, because the last thing we want to do is put this animal in renal disease as well. I'm sorry? Yeah. Okay. Perioperative analgesia, you guys have much more experience with this than I do. My suggestion would be to use one that's approved for use, injectable, that you can go to oral if you're worried about transitioning. That way you don't have to worry about transitioning. The other point of this slide is to anticipate about 10% opioid rescue being necessary. And that's just preliminary data. Eventually we may find out more. Animals do need opioid rescue. In general, the efficacy of the nonsteroidals in the clinical trials have been equal to butorphanol, which in my mind is not a particularly good analgesic, and also equal to buprenorphine in efficacy. However, buprenorphine is longer in duration. Buprenorphine will probably last longer than your nonsteroidals will. So, you can use them in combination. Well, as I already talked about combination, so I'm not going to talk about it anymore. So the point about this slide is that they are very effective perioperative analgesics, but you may need to have some opioid rescue in some of these animals. We'll finish up with a couple of comments about the cat and nonsteroidals. There is a need to improve because we don't have any clue of what's COX-1 sparing versus COX-2 in the cat. We need pharmacokinetic studies. We need stereoisomer studies. It's just a mess out there. However, if I were going to pick one, it would be meloxicam. Why? Because it's approved for use in the United States, and I can't see too awful much reason for using something else if meloxicam will fit the bill, and there's no other drug that's approved for long-term use, so why not use meloxicam long-term use? And the reason for that is also this. This is the half-life of each of these nonsteroidals in cats. The number in parentheses is the half-life in dogs, and you can see that in the cat, there are several drugs that actually have a shorter half-life in the cat compared to the dog, and it turns out that these are the drugs that the cat tolerates very well. Ketoprofen, meloxicam, piroxicam, and interestingly, Zubrin. And in fact, you probably can use Zubrin. I think the dose is 3 mg per kg, but I need to double check on that. But I haven't heard a lot of veterinarians using it yet, but not Fort Dodge. Fort Dodge has provided us some information that we can use and suggest that possibly it can be used in cats. So I'm going to set that aside. That's actually kind of interesting because the cat with feline bronchial asthma, the idea of using a drug that targets leukotrienes is potentially appealing. I haven't used it as a non-steroidal to control pain, so I'm just going to set that out for you to think about, and let me come back to these other drugs. So let's look at meloxicam first. It's approved for use in the injectable form in the United States. It's been used a long time in Canada, effectively long-term as well. I understand that the package insert says that this drug is not approved for long-term use in cats, but you can use it long-term use in cats. The FDA probably asked Boehringer Ingelheim to put that on the package insert to make sure you understood that it has not been approved for oral use long-term. Half-life is 15 hours in the cats versus dogs of 20 hours. I'm not sure if that's really that important. The approved dose is 0.3 mg per kg. That's the injectable perioperative dose. The one thing that I'm going to warn you of is when the drug was looked at chronically at 0.3 to 0.6 mg per kg, it was not well tolerated. So if you do use it long term, do not use it at the perioperative dose. Drop down here and use it at a lower dose. What has been recommended by our friends in Canada, they recommend a 0.2 mg per kg loading dose, followed by a 0.1 mg per kg daily once a day for 4 days, followed by a 0.1 mg per cat daily. Well, if you ask me, you're just asking for trouble if you do this. My suggestion is if you want to load these cats, and the reason for loading is it takes you about 2 days to get to steady state, you load the cat in your practice, and then you send the client home with the daily dose. And if you do use a higher daily dose initially, as is recommended here, I would not let the client know that this is higher and then you're backing down. I think it would be more prudent to send the animal home on 0.1 milligram or I've seen up to 0.2 milligrams per cat once a day. Now, this is a drug that you're going to have to get compounded. The way that it's set up is, at least in Canada, what they like is having it set up so that one drop contains the amount of drug that you're going to give to a cat. So one drop would contain 0.1 milligram. The problem with that is this, coming back to accuracy and dosing. Now the client, when you're dealing with a drop, well, it's real easy to convince yourself, I'm just going to give 2 drops today because, you know, a drop's not very much. So if you're going to get this compounded, I would encourage you to get it compounded at a concentration that makes it easier for a client to more accurately dose and harder for a client to overdose. Does that make sense? So I'd probably do it so that the dose is delivered in a third of a mil or something like that. When you look at side effects on the FDA website for meloxicam, vomiting is not at the top of the list. What is at the top of the list is creatinine and BUN and anorexia. So my concern is, once again, the cat is going to have a problem with renal effects more than gastrointestinal effects. So I would monitor these cats. I would get their creatinine and BUN up front. If they're high normal, I'd watch these cats like a hawk. Ketoprofen has been used in Canada. It's actually approved for use in Canada. It has a long term of safe use in cats. It has been used by veterinarians in the United States. I'm going to tell you, at least in my mind, I wouldn't do it anymore because we have meloxicam, and meloxicam will do it just as well. And from a professional liability issue, if you get caught using a drug that is extra label when there is an approved version in the cat, it just, to me, it seems that you're putting yourself at risk. Further, ketoprofen has been associated with acute renal failure postoperatively in both dogs and cats and an increased risk of bleeding with declaws. And, of course, meloxicam probably should not do that. I do think, looking at the data, meloxicam probably is a COX-1 protective drug in cats. It has been used favorably in cats, equal to buprenorphine as far as efficacy for cats undergoing neutering. But, again, there still need to anticipate about a 10% rescue. Carprofen, just don't go there. Doesn't make sense. The one study that was reported in the AHA journal, the clients and the veterinarians neglected to take the cat off carprofen. It's approved for use in Europe at a much lower dose. If you go to the website, you will see that vomiting is the major side effect, but once again, here's renal issues in the cat, so in my mind, it's just not worth it. So, in the cat, using non-steroidals perioperatively and even long-term, again, as I said, anticipate about a 10% opioid rescue. Otherwise, you can use the drug quite safely in cats. And that's all I have to say. Can I answer any questions for you? Yes, ma'am. I can't hear you. I'm sorry. If the animal's on aspirin and they want to use Rimadyl, how long? Is this in dog?
Yeah.
The half-life of aspirin is 9 hours. So you could probably wait one day and go the next day to Rimadyl. Just recognize that platelets will be altered for 14 days. Okay. There was another question? Yes, ma'am. Most excellent question. How long do I wait after steroids? And that question is going to be much harder to answer because I don't know that anybody knows. I'm going to assume it's not a long-acting depot form. I'm going to assume it's something like prednisone and prednisolone. I probably would wait 3 to 5 days. Okay. And then what I would really do is I would protect because I don't know. Okay. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that's a good question. The point is that the problem is when the clients read the tear-offs, then they go back to aspirin because they think that aspirin is really safe. I guess one of the things, if you had some published information, I suppose that would probably help. And I'm not sure the best way, this data here, the notes, those sort of things, but the reality is, and I understand, the clients still are not going to see that aspirin. Until the human sector has convinced people that it's not safe for them, then they're probably going to assume it's safe for animals as well. So I don't have a real good answer for you except to try and emphasize that it's a terrible drug. It is. Pardon? You what?
I said, if you want to give aspirin, you go right ahead and I will not see you again.
You divorced them. Is that what you said?
When you say that to them, they go, ooh.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, one thing I didn't say about sucralfate is you should never give it with another drug because it will probably bind that other drug and prevent its absorption. Sucralfate requires maximal acidity, and so ideally you would give sucralfate first and then follow another hour later with your anti-secretory drug. So yes, you're right, and thank you for bringing that to my attention.
One other question in the case of the toxicity on the drug, once the animal has recovered, assuming they recover from the toxicity situation, should you avoid
I don't think, once an animal's safely gotten through toxicity, one of the things I forgot to emphasize is don't forget to treat the renal disease there. And I know that you guys know that, but don't forget to do that. But once they've gotten beyond that, then you can probably start that. There's no reason for that animal to be predisposed to toxicity again if the reason for the toxicity was ingestion, okay, over-ingestion, or you inappropriately overdosed. Other questions? Okay, enjoy your evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.